sitting there by the left turn line, a flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him, the VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. That big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills. But they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. You see those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot. Cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack. Just busted concrete and rusted tracks. Empty storefronts around the square. There's a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. And the bar's still open, but man, it's slow. The tip jar's light and the register's low. The bartender don't much to say, but the regular crowd gets thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit cards, some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, just try it yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore.
It's a great song, and I like to play it. It's long. I think it's 6 or 7 minutes long, so I didn't play it all, but that's a very important song that everybody should hear. Well, it is the 28th of July, 2016, getting real close to August, so if you're going to get it done in July, you better get it done because you don't have much longer to do it. Don't forget to send all your winnings from the lottery to P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. What is it? 455 or 60 million? Ha! What the hell would you do with that? Well, I could outfit a goddamn army, I'll tell you that. Yeah. We could buy all this weapons of mass destruction brand new. We wouldn't have to piddle around with repairing and bondoing up these older machines like we have to do. But I remember Dennis Mahan used to always say, well, when I hit the lottery, I'm going to give you a lot of money. Right. Believe me, if anyone in the white racial struggle won $450 million in a lottery, they would finagle, the government would finagle some way to keep you from getting it. Just like they did the just like they did the National Alliance, and they've done it to a lot of people. And a lot of people don't know, but some people get willed property and everything else, and then they pass away, and people in the struggle that they wanted it to go to don't get it, because the heirs find the wills and tear them up and so forth and so on, or rewrite to phony up a new will. I know we've lost some money a couple of times that way. Not great big money, but enough that would help out. I think we've still got a couple of things willed to us way out there someplace, but I don't depend on that stuff, so I forgot about it. If it comes, it comes. Question, am I a homophobe, or is this Tim Kaine look like he's a little light in the loafers? The way he holds his mouth and the way he speaks tells me, if I'm not mistaken, he's a homosexual. Now, I don't know. He may say he's got a nice family and everything like that, but there's a lot of those kind of guys around. They have beards, you know. People used to have allegations that Tom Cruise was homosexual, but he had beards. He'd marry these women just as fronts. What do you think of this speech that Bill Clinton gave about his wonderful wife and how he met her? That's unbelievable. He didn't talk about all these other women he was screwing all over the country, probably hundreds of them, and how she let him do it. She didn't leave him or anything, so which means Hillary has been a full-time pimp for Bill Clinton for decades. What else could you say? She stood by. She knew he was having all these sexapades. And even going over to this island where they had young, real young girls and stuff like that, some of these big shots. I'm telling you, if you think Washington is corrupt, you don't know half of it. It's so corrupt, it's just unbelievable. And with the seediest of people. Well, I see they're going to let the young man who took a shot at Reagan out. His name escapes me at the moment. I'll remember it in 5 minutes from now. 35 years for taking a shot at Reagan. They should have been out in half the time. Just like Sirhan should be out in half the time. Or even, I forget his name. But you see, if you shoot or kill a big shot, they really hit you hard. If you just get a normal working person, or even just a working street-type black person, and if you're not proven to be a racist, you get out pretty quick. And over in Europe, their sentences over there are hell of a lot less than they are over here. I mean, guys are getting out in about 7 or 8 years for murder. Unbelievable. Well, it's too bad in some ways that he didn't finish the job, because I know a lot of you people still got some conservative leanings. Ronald Reagan was a rat, and I've told you that over and over. I'm not going to go through it. But he was a war criminal. He's responsible for thousands and thousands of people being killed and murdered in Central and South America. They killed 7,000 in Panama. And he's also responsible for the massive amount of drugs brought into this country by the CIA and dumped into the black, mostly black communities around the country, to which most people would say, well, I don't care about that. Well, you should, because when they reach a certain level, then they start selling it to the whites. And the whites surely bought a lot of it. They were bringing all those airliners into Mena Airport down there in Arkansas, and Bill Clinton knew all about it. So Ronald Reagan is, well, he's a big liar, man. He said he'd been in World War II. He never left Hollywood. He said he'd visited the concentration camps in Germany and Poland. He never was in Europe. And what gets me is how these neocons, or just conservatives, worship that guy, worshiping like a god. They call streets after him and airports after him and schools after him. Of course, there's a lot more just like him. It seems like the biggest criminals get the biggest monuments. The people who kill the most people, murder the most people, get the adulation of the crowd, which is very interesting. You kill one person in a stick-up to get a loaf of bread at a liquor store, and you're gone for 50 years. You kill thousands of people, tens of thousands of people, sometimes millions of people, and you never do any time at all. Just like Hillary. She's responsible for all kinds of dead people. But so's her husband. I mean, all those politicians have signed bills and laws into action and voted for a bloated military budget. See, we got to have more and more killing devices. We got to ship more and more devices over there to the Middle East. Millions, millions of dollars. Because the investors back here want to make a lot of profit on those weapons. Yeah, that's a lot of the reason for the NRA, and that's another story. People that think the NRA is just in business to protect your right to keep and bear arms are not playing with a full deck. There's a lot more to the what's in the background of the NRA. That's why I would never have never joined the NRA. Well, we got a winner. We got a winner on the contest we started yesterday. How about that? Yeah, I'm not going to give the name, but the winner was south of the Mason-Dixon line quite a ways. And he wins a $20 re-up to the shows for August. So we've already marked him down, and his answer was the 1936 Constitution of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, which I have sitting right here on my desk, and he was right. Underneath the Constitution, they have the statement, fundamental law. Almost everything you see in our Constitution, you'll see in this book. So don't make any difference what they say, it's what they do that counts. So congratulations out there. Well, I ask you what you thought about Tim Kaine. My gal calls it gaydar. She got gaydar. And I guess I got gaydar a little bit too. And I'm not sure, but I got an idea that the old Timmy boy is a little light in the loafers, like I said before. Says Senator Tim Kaine, Hillary Clinton's pick for president, of course he would be no threat to her, is a devout Catholic who sings tenor in the choir of the church he has attended regularly for 30 years. As he reminded his fellow Democrats last night, he went to a Jesuit high school and worked with the Jesuit missionaries in Honduras. He quotes freely from the Bible. Well, isn't that good? Why didn't he work in the Negro ghetto of the United States? No, it's more admirable to go to Honduras. And he was and maybe he could get away with a little more of his sexual escapades in Honduras, too, out of the limelight. And he has a very Jewish way of squaring faith and politics. How about that? Tim sees his faith in Jewish terms, as Dina de Malkutadina, said Rabbi Jack Moline, executive director of the Interfaith Alliance, who has known Cain well for 15 years. I'll bet he has. The Aramaic saying, dating back to the Talmud, translates roughly as the law of the kingdom is the law. It's the rule that says that the law of one's country is binding, even if, in some cases, it contradicts Jewish law. The concept took root centuries ago as a pragmatic way to justify Jewish acquiescence to Gentile rulers, and has found modern expression in some legal disputes in Israel. Cain doesn't use that precise phrase, naturally, but Moline has discussed the concept at length with the vice presidential nominee, dating back to his days as governor of Virginia. Quote, for him, the rabbi said, no amount of personal preference, even if based on deeply held religious beliefs, supersedes the Constitution, unquote. If you believe that, you'll buy some swampland down there in Florida, or in the southeast someplace. In practical terms, this means that Cain is personally against abortion, but is an outspoken supporter of reproductive rights codified by Roe versus Wade. He's personally against the death penalty, but as governor, he signed about 15 warrants for execution. He must not be against it too badly. And I'll bet you most of those were blacks, too. So I wonder how the Black Lives Matter are going to take that. They probably won't even talk about it, because most of these people sell out no matter what color they are. In political terms, Cain may be the sign of things to come. He's not the first devout Catholic to navigate this delicate path. Remember the late Mario Cuomo's brilliant exposition of the role of a Catholic lawmaker back in 1984? Nor is Cain the only public official on today's stage to make the distinction between personal belief and public responsibility. Joe Biden, the first Catholic vice president, comes to mind. Well, anyhow, that's enough of that. I wonder if that homosexual that was in Congress for so long? Barney Fife? No, Barney something. Yeah. At least he was out in the open with it. He ran a homo whorehouse. Yeah, he ran a homo whorehouse all the time he was, or at least most of the time he's in Congress, so. Anyhow, we'll see. We'll see what happens here. But the first one of you people out there that can supply me credible evidence that Cain is a homosexual person, I'd appreciate it to come to me direct. That's because I'm a homophobe. No, if homos don't bother me, I don't bother them. I just get a little turned off at the sexual acts they get involved with, you know, that, what do they call that, the brown dipstick and all that kind of stuff. That gets a little unsanitary for me, man. I think if I showed some of these more grotesque sexual acts on television, there'd be a lot less people inclined to be happy with homosexuals. See a little bit more on this Tim Cain. Is Hillary Clinton's pick for vice president? Well, we know that. Somewhat to the chagrin of the Democratic Party's left wing, there's a lot more critical of Jews in that left wing. I mean the real left wing. And the somewhat premature excitement of Wikipedia. He is one of the longest records of service in politics among people on Clinton's shortlist, going back to his 1997 election as the mayor of Richmond, Virginia. Cain has also been a friend to the Jewish community for about as long he's been in public service. During his various campaigns, Cain has repeatedly reached out to the Jewish community, conducts interviews with Jewish leaders, and spoke about America's relationship to Israel. Well, I guess you got to do that. You got to go along to get along, right? Quote, he made himself very available to the Jewish community, unquote. Did he make himself available to the Aryan community? Said, anyhow, the executive director of the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Washington, he took the Jewish community very seriously as a constituency. You better. He'd better, even though it only represented a small portion of the Virginia electorate. But Tommy says it did represent some of the rich, rich people. But Kane is connected to the Jewish community in several other ways as well. Here are five facts about Tim Kaine's relationship to Judaism in Israel. He supports a two-state solution even when others don't. Okay. Number two. He's a religious Catholic, so he understands the imperatives and difficulties of observance. These so far is not too exciting. Not too much different. He brought hummus to Virginia. What the hell is hummus? During his time as governor of Virginia, Sabra built what is reportedly the world's largest hummus factory outside Richmond, capable of producing 8,000 tons of hummus a month. Kane was apparently directly involved. He's the man who brought Sabra hummus to Virginia, unquote, said Rabbi Jack Moline, the executive director of the Interfaith Alliance. According to Moline, Kane wooed the company to set up shop in his state. I guess that, whatever it is, has some connection to the Jews. I mean, outside of money. Kane authorized $350,000 from the government's Opportunity Fund to help bring the project to fruition, beating out two other states for the privilege of being the heart of America's hummus production. Well, I'm going to have to look that up in a dictionary, or you're going to have to tell me what the hummus is. He hosted a Passover Seder multiple times during his first year as governor. He hosted the first ever Passover Seder in the government's mansion. He is apparently part of the group of friends that rotates hosting the Seder each year. And that year, it happened to be his turn. It wasn't his first time hosting. His home had been a slot in rotating group for for several years before his election, even. Well, that probably got him elected, or helped get him elected. You can't go wrong betting on no damn Jews, man. He played Yente, matchmaking for Rabbi Jack Moline's daughter. Moline's daughter and son-in-law met while working on Kane's campaign for governor in Virginia in 2005. If he hadn't run for governor, I wouldn't be a grandfather, said Moline. Well, I'm sure there's a lot more devious things hidden under the floorboards, but that was the five things that this Jewish outfit said good about this guy, Haynes. Yeah. I think it was Hillary's way of, through the back door, calming down a lot of criticism she gets about the things she does that have to do with Jews. She has pissed off a lot of Jews, that's for sure. So this guy's coming along to calm things down a little bit. There's always a reason for these things. Not the good of the country, of course. Definitely not the good of the Aryan race. I don't know whether you noticed it, but Bill Clinton did something the night he gave a speech at the Democratic Convention. Because, as anyone watching MSNBC, a super left-wing outfit, could see, Bill Clinton was wearing a Hebrew lapel pin at the DNC on Wednesday night that read, in Hebrew transliteration, Hillary. Well, maybe she converted secretly to being a Jew. That seems to have been one of the Clinton team's firm but clear responses to those who burned the Israeli flag on Tuesday night. Ooh, I heard some flags were burnt, but I didn't hear it was the Israeli flag. Ha, 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 ha. Oh, man. Okay. a pro-Palestinian protester wearing a bandana over her face and chanting "Long live the Intifada" burned an Israeli flag outside the Democrat National Convention in Philadelphia last night. The anti-Israel demonstration came as a crowd of 2,000 protesters marched on the convention last night shouting pro-Bernie Sanders chants and holding signs reading "Bernie or bust, Bernie Trump's hate." Dozens of people were detained, though no arrests. And here's what it sounded like when they had the demonstration outside the DNC. I screwed up there again. I pressed the wrong button. Now I got two pieces of the show. That's all right. I'll send them out to you, two pieces, but the webmaster, she'll splice them together when we put them up on the website. So I think I'd learn how to edit these damn shows after all this time, but I still don't have it down pat or down at all, mainly because the MP3 recorder that allows me to do all that is hard to operate. It's got so many buttons on it, it's unbelievable. Anyhow, they were burning Israel flag and American flag also. So I don't think I saw that on television. Well, I had to fire up a fan down here in the bunker. The humidity is going through the roof again, or it's pretty rough. So I had to fire up a fan. I hope it doesn't interfere with my audio on the show. Well, here's a little bit that has to do with Hinckley, the alleged attempted assassin of Ronald Bedtime for Bozo Reagan. I'm not going to play the whole thing because it's an hour and 27 minutes. But I'll send it to you and you can listen to it.
Team, but then at the last minute, about 3 days before the shooting, Bush was put in to head the crisis management team, and the press couldn't quite figure out what it was, and they were chasing him around saying, what's a crisis, and what's crisis management, and what's this all got to do with? And what it has to do with, of course, is transfer of power and control in either natural or created crises in the White House. And at the level of the presidency. So they asked Bush 3 days before the shooting, how would you define a crisis? And Bush says, the president will know it when he sees it. Flat on his back, I suppose, was the scenario. And I think he did see it coming out of that Hilton there in Washington, and I did extensive work on the ballistics. None of Hinckley's bullets hit Mr. Reagan. Hinckley had six bullets in the gun. One hit Delahanty, a cop, and threw him to the ground by nicking him on grazing his shoulder and neck. Another went into the groin of the agent McCarthy, a 160-pound man, lifted him up and threw him back to the other end of the limousine. Another bullet, the initial bullet fired by Hinckley, hit Mr. Brady in the head, knocked him to the ground, did considerable brain damage. And one bullet nicked the windshield of the limousine. One bullet went into the Universal office building across the street. And one bullet went into the trunk of the car. And you can see when you look at the photos closely, a very clear hole, not a ricochet or a scar mark, but a hole going into the car, penetrating the outer metal wall. The bullet that hit Reagan hit him by all counts at an early point. When the limousine pulled up to deliver him to his talk, It pulled up at the door where he was to go in. I suppose if you rented a limousine, you'd expect it to come to your door, not two doors down the block. If you're the President of the United States, they will move it 6 inches to make it sure it lines up with the door. They were following standard security procedure when he got there. The limousine stopped, the door opened. The Secret Service got out on both sides and formed a human wall. And then Reagan gets out and walks through that wall a couple of seconds into the door, the VIP entrance, and through some non-public halls and up an elevator and out on the stage. He comes back by the same route in order to beat the crowd out. This was specifically designed there at the Hilton for that purpose, this route. But when he comes out, the limousine inexplicably is about 40 feet down the curb, nowhere near the door. So he has to walk out into the open. When the president walks in the open, the Secret Service are supposed to stand on either side into the front and back, as well as other points, but at least a protective diamond. The Secret Service file out all to his right, a line of ducks. They told him that morning, no security problem, Mr. President, you need to wear your vest. He raised his hand to wave, some called Mr. President, raised his hand to wave, and at that point he's hit. You can tell he's hit. He, in the Kennedy assassination, because the missile went into his lung, the lung begins to collapse, the air is blown out, and the cheeks expand. And you get a grimace on the face. His shoulder slumps a little bit, he's clearly in pain. And all of the magazines, Time magazine, go back to that point, show Reagan is hit. He's up like this. But that point is at almost the same second that Hinckley's first bullet is fired and hits Brady in the head. And realizing that Reagan is not dead, Secret Service Agent Parr begins to push him into the car in front of him. And Reagan's already in the car, and Parr about a third of the way into the car when Hinckley's last shot is fired. So there's no chance in timing or angles or anything else for these bullets to hit Reagan. The reaction of all the other people is much different than Reagan. Reagan's still standing, and then he gets into the car. So they're all lying around the ground from these 38 shots. If a 38 caliber, even a 22 caliber bullet had hit Reagan, he wouldn't have been wondering whether something had happened to him. A good assassin, even if you have your vest on, knows that when you raise your hand, you expose your heart. And the situation was that up top of the retaining wall on the area that I call the Bushy Knoll, was the assassin. And he was firing not a 38 or a 22, but a very, very specific weapon developed by the intelligence agencies, which is a CO2-propelled flechette. These are little razor-edged or sharp discs, or they have them, earlier versions were like little tube rockets, about a half an inch long, very thin with stabilizing fins. Then they got into these little discs that are razor-edged and delta-shaped or airline-shaped so that they... And this thing makes no noise. It's just a little puff of CO2 gas, and it can be fired with accuracy up to an amazing distance. Some of the guns that incorporated this early technology were revealed by Senator Church during the CIA assassination studies in Congress, and they had a looked like a German Luger with a rifle scope on it that would fire these things accurately with the scope to the length of a football field. So there's no problem with aiming them or getting them to do the job. And I have to assume that Luger was the expendable technology and they got better, or they wouldn't show it to us on TV. And they could shoot you from a satellite. They don't have to worry about a gun barrel. But not with a 22, of course, but with other types of energy and heat generating stuff they can send down by satellite. And if they can knock a ICBM missile traveling through outer space out of the sky, I'm sure they can catch you on the street. So once they get Star Wars in place, the cities are the first target, I think. They can start firestorms and other things. But this guy made such a little wound with this disc, when they often contain poison and might have, in Reagan's case, that later led to the cancer, but also can just be used. I think the idea was to penetrate the heart, but it deflected on the seventh rib and went into the lung and missed the aorta by about a quarter of an inch. They couldn't find the bullet. The nurses couldn't find a bullet wound. Now, this is GWU Hospital emergency room in D.C. They've seen bullet wounds, believe me. They didn't know what was wrong. They thought he was having a heart attack. Finally, when they got all his clothes cut off, the nurse saw what she described, and I read the medical magazines about this, and she said it was a little razor slit, about an inch long, with some black blood coming out of it, a little line of blood. And then she thought, well, you know, maybe he's been hit with something. But that isn't what a 22 or a 38 hole would look like. And then they went in and they couldn't find it, and they almost closed him up. They did three different x-rays to find the bullet. And then the doctor, the last time, just before closing, got the thing in his hand, in his lung tissue, and pulled it out. And he described it in the medical magazine as round, flat as a dime, as round as a dime, about that size, and flat, razor-edged. And then he hands it to the FBI that's waiting patiently. And it goes the way of all good bullets. Back into the history bin. So we don't hear about that bullet anymore. We hear about these 22 exploding shells and ricochet shot that must have hit the back of the car and gone between the door of the car and gotten into Reagan on his way in. Because otherwise, how do you explain the wound described by Dr. O'Donnell that night at the press conference as a 45 degree downward back to front left to right wound, when you have Reagan here and Hinckley down about where you are? How are you going to get me from back there? You know, it just didn't fit. So then you got to bend Reagan over like this and come back in from the other side of the car or something. I mean, you know, it was almost as impossible as the magic bullet in the Kennedy assassination, but these are minor details when you're killing a president. They did not expect him to survive. They got into the car without even police escort, and they yelled, "Rawhide is okay." Rawhide being his code name at the time. "Rawhide is okay." You know, oops, gig's up. So next, plan B, and Brady at that point is lying on the ground bleeding, and there is an early report that Brady is dead. Then there's a report that Reagan is shot, then that Brady's shot or not dead, or Reagan's not dead, or Reagan's dead, and it went back and forth like that for a while, and the press couldn't seem to get it straight. And I'm turning on everything I can turn on, radio and TV, you know, the minute I hear it, because I know you're going to get the only news in the first few minutes. And the situation is, somebody comes into GWU Hospital on a stretcher, Secret Service all around, and they come in a few minutes before and they clear out the emergency room, and they bring this guy through on a stretcher. So everybody assumes it's Reagan, he's hit, maybe he's dead, and he's going into surgery. But in fact, having looked at the case very closely, I now realize that that was Brady. Brady beat Reagan to the hospital. Brady, who took 3 more minutes to even get an ambulance near him, got to GWU before Reagan did. And then in the book that McCarthy writes about protecting the president that day, he says that they got in the car and they said they were going to take him to the nearest hospital, which you've got to do, and so they went up T Street to Connecticut, and they said into the thing, "We're going right. We're going to," and then he says another code word, doesn't put it in there, but he says it means the White House. And if you go right on Connecticut Avenue at T Street in Washington, D.C., you're heading north, away from the White House, and up to another place in Maryland where the body of John Kennedy got taken, called Bethesda Naval Hospital, so that the United States Navy intelligence can finish the job on Mr. Reagan. In fact, Secret Service agents argued with hospital staff at GWU all night until 6 in the morning. They finally gave up trying to move him up to Bethesda. They wanted to do the killing and the autopsy up there, where they could control it. They didn't want him down in a public hospital. But a huge fight broke out between the Reagan loyalists and the Bush loyalists in the Situation Room in that hour, at the command and control module, which is the communication module in the White House for all the nuclear and crisis commands, sat Helena von Dahm. Reagan's appointment secretary in Otto von Bolschwing's employ. And the fight ensued to the point that a deal was made to let Reagan live as long as he got out of the way. Haig emerged, shaken, Bush's man, and said, "Gentlemen, I am in charge here until the vice president returns." Bush was flying out in Dallas on Air Force One, and so the transition of power, I believe, happened at that point. Hinckley was an easy enough patsy to set up and blame the murder on. Reagan managed to survive, but then from then on, basically went out to Camp David, watched old movies with Nancy, waved at the press, you know, "Oh, I'm the president, want to see my boots?" And Bush ran the White House. The Contragate scandal then came in, created, I believe, by Bush. Oliver North is Bush's boy, and when you look at the testimony of North concerning this scandal, there's a point at which George Bush calls Oliver North at a hotel room, and he describes this call. He says, "I picked up the phone and I jumped to attention for the president." Kissinger and Kramer and Haig and Bush and Scowcroft and Brzezinski and North is the team that moves in this scandal. North is both CIA and DIA, National Security Council link, and he does several jobs for Bush, I believe. One being Operation Eagle Claw, the sabotage of a rescue attempt on the hostages in Iran that was never meant to rescue them, a covert operation handed over to Carter without his knowledge of what was up, run by Operation Yellow Fruit and the Independent Support Agency and the Delta Force and the secret counterterrorism teams that were created under Bush and all the Bush operatives. The Navy Task Force 59 under North. This was not a rescue mission. It was 800 miles from Tehran on a desert road near the Afghan border. It was a switch, I believe, of guns for drugs. You don't need five C-130 planes to refuel eight Huey helicopters. These choppers were defective. They were taken up out of the barrels of the Independence at sea just to make sure the sand shields were pulled off of the engine covers so that they would crash in the incident. And these Hueys, at best, on a full tank, will go 600 miles. I looked them up in Janes. So you've got to refuel twice, once on the way in to take over Iran with eight helicopters, and then once on the way out. Well, once we lost the three chopper, I mean, even Americans can't take Tehran with just five Hueys. I almost had them by the tail. This was run by Mr. Secord, among others. And it effectively embarrassed Carter.
Okay, I sent you that whole thing. It's an hour and 27 minutes long, and I think you'll find it quite interesting. Could be false flag. I don't know. Sounds like a lot of very interesting information to me. And it fits Murder Incorporated that they exist in our government, which has led me to believe almost every killing or death, accidental or otherwise, in the political system is assassinations and so forth. Americans don't want to believe that about their country. At least they got a little change in the Kennedy assassination. But they generally don't want to believe that our government could be so rotten and so corrupted. Well, I see that Black Lives Matter has got a problem with Hillary. Mrs. Clinton's history... Wait a minute. Mrs. Clinton's history-making nomination was greeted with a mass disapproval by the Black Lives Matter movement just a couple of hours after the nomination took place. Well, they should have figured that out even when Obama ran. They think Obama was a wonderful black man interested in their well-being. How foolish can they be? This is the same as white people who think because somebody's white, they're for the white race. This serves as a great concern for the first female presidential candidate of a major political party in America because she has been trying to win the hearts of the black community to ensure her victory comes in November during the presidential polls. Well, these people always do that. They march out and going to support somebody because they think they're on their side. They're only on their own side. Hillary Clinton's on her side. That's only one side, even separate from Bill. Hillary's going to survive no matter what because it's her against the world. Obama's the same way. These are these psychopaths. They're psychopaths. And for any group of people, no matter what race they are or what religion they are or anything, to think they're on their side are stupid. And so we got 8 years of black people thinking, oh, he's on our side. What fools we mortals be, whether black or white. Now, on these charges dropped on this Freddie death, which leads me to believe what happened there was he simply wouldn't sit down and maintain himself, and he got up and jumped around and maybe tried to wrestle with the cops and fell down and screwed up his neck or broke his back or whatever. But I noticed that three out of the, five or six cops are black. So why aren't the Black Lives Matter people demonstrating against those black cops? Here's a little article trying to explain lone wolves. Let's see what they got to say. After each atrocity, social media hosts the well-rehearsed rituals of mourning. News of the identification of the perpetrators is frequently followed by condemnation of the double standard of media coverage in relation to geography and language, particularly regarding the word terrorist. It's worth reading the BBC's guidance about why it prefers not to use the term altogether. In recent months, it has become clear that there is frustration about the application of mental health diagnosis, especially in relationship to white male violence, as well as confusion about the relationship between mental illness and terrorism. This is fraught with a difficult subject, rarely discussed sensitively on a platform such as Twitter, which rewards simplification and polarization. After the killing of Joe Cox in Britain, there was justifiable anger and depoliticalization of her murder. Many media outlets chose not to highlight Thomas Meagher's links to far-right white supremacist groups. I can see where this is going already. His act certainly fits the definition of terrorism, one who uses violence or the threat of violence to further their political aims. Well, that makes the presidents of the United States and all the leaders of all the countries, almost all the countries, terrorists, because that's what they do. They use violence to further their political aims. They spend trillions of your dollars doing it. Although this does not discount the possibility that Meagher may have suffered mental illness, nor does it negate the importance of a diagnosis. Rather, a reductionist either-or, is it ideology or is it pathology? Chemicals in the brain or ideas in the mind? Well, my suspicion is that most of these situations are people who are pissed off and they're alone by themselves. They don't have any kind of social support. And they start yapping their mouth and the federals hear about it. And they say, well, here's a good patsy. So they get with them, play them along, and educate them a little more on being nasty and doing nasty things. and all of a sudden they've got a so-called terrorist. And what usually happens is they'll talk the person to make a move, not a great big move, but a move. And at the same time, the federal agents and so forth are planning their big move following the little move to make sure that enough people die and make sure the right people die. And that's my suspicion that most of these are like that. It's important to acknowledge that mental ideological elements, there's a public bravura that prevents politicians from acknowledging this nuance. Those that dissent are forced to state the obvious. To understand is not to justify. All of which serves an indulgence of ignorance, a dangerous form of self-denial. You ever notice how these people write? A lot of these people write gobbledygooky. They don't speak straight, plain English. In 2016, amid a wave of attacks from lone wolf terrorists, clarity and honesty is urgently needed. The lone wolf evolves in three key stages: isolation, inspiration, emulation. For a recent BBC documentary on the Unabomber, I interviewed a former FBI special agent, Kathleen Puckett, a behavioral psychologist who worked on the Unabomb task force following the capture of Ted Kaczynski. Puckett was commissioned to write a report called The Lone Terrorist, comparing the Unabomber with other high-profile cases, including the Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh and Eric Rudolph, who bombed the 1996 Atlanta Olympics. Puckett told me about the report. Well, seems to me that Timothy McVeigh did have a support group of some type. Not many, but essentially the primary finding was that all of them had an intense desire to be part of a group, and they were always extremist groups. Yeah, well, that's why I tell people not to join all these groups. But they have an intense desire, and people, you know, like these right-wing leaders, play on that, you know. Oh, yeah, join our outfit, and we'll give you the straight scoop, but give us some money, too. There are people who want to be members of groups but can't affiliate or can't make the internal connections with other people well enough to become a member. Well, I know for a fact that in all my years, 40 years of playing around with groups, that they attract some really weird people. I got to tell you, man, when I ran the Klan, there were some really strange people wanted in, and I tried to keep them out. And it's one of the reasons I quit the Klan, was because the people you were having go out and recruit, unfortunately, we're recruiting the wrong people. They were recruiting down instead of up, psychologically and militarily and so forth. The group rejects them, or they reject the group. They're angry because they're stymied in their lack of ability to make connections that they want. If you're not in a group, how do you matter in the world? You see, that's chat rooms. There you go. That's the beginning, chat rooms. How do you make a mark? You have to do a societal level of violence. So the connection that they make is to the ideology itself. We said years ago that what we were really worried about was the lone terrorist ideology and the phenomenon being adopted by international terrorism, and of course that has happened. It's not that these people are being recruited, but they're self-recruiting because they are alienated. The Boston bombers, for example, Tasmarimi wrote in his social media, "I don't have a single American friend." Yeah, you see, that's the problem with most people. They got to have people around them. They got to have friends. You know, that's why all these guys get together. They go to the football game and all that crap. I've never had that problem. I've always had friends, but not friends that I couldn't do without. And not friends that I got to hang out with all the time. Now, is that weird? Am I psychologically screwed up? No, I think I'm very healthy because hanging around with a lot of people is not only a waste of time, it's dangerous and really time-wasting. In place of intimacy, ideology fulfills their desire for connection. Well, that's the same way with people who belong to the Catholic Church or the political parties, and you see the Democratic Convention right now, people want to be part of something. I got to be part of something. I'll be a Democrat, and I'll sit down with all these other upset people and isolated people, and then we'll be one, and we'll have our queen, and she'll lead us into victory. Our Joan of Arc, Hillary. This goes on throughout society. Don't narrow it down just to certain political lone wolves. Isolation and marginalization do not prohibit them from interaction, but makes particularly susceptible to online radicalization. I think the movies and the television shows, violent shows, do more to do that than any group, any especially smaller groups. Some of them are bullied, some experience racism, and many entertain fantasies of revenge. Well, I think a lot of people entertain fantasies. If you start dragging everybody off to the jail, it has fantasies. Every time I see a pretty girl walking down the street swinging her rear end around, I have fantasies. That doesn't mean I'm a pervert or I'm a sex maniac. Some in Brian Mitchell Jenkins' characterization. Now, this Jenkins, I think, was one I ran into years ago, who's a big fat guy in this left-wing thing. He was always attacking us racial separatists and even right-wingers. He's still around, I guess. Are stray dogs rather than lone wolves? Well, either way you want to put it, whatever turns you on. Looking for a cause that will give them meaning and make sense of their mental turmoil, which fits about everybody in the world. Crucially, an extremist ideology offers them the possibility of transforming their identity to re-imaging themselves not as failures but as warriors. Was that like all the thousands of guys that joined the military? What about all of them that after the 9/11, they all ran off and joined the military? They really didn't have a good reason. They made up the reason in their head. Whose prior difficulties are not personal shortcomings, but evidence of the cultural decadence that they now disavow. Well, people should disavow the cultural and racial decadence. While recognizing the cognitive utility of radical ideology, we shouldn't discount the romantic appeal of the ideas themselves. You see that every day in the movies. You go down to the movies or watch it on television. I'm watching one series now, A Strike Back. It was British series, and it's the most violent goddamn thing I've ever watched. There's more shooting and more killing and direct killing, and nobody gets off. They just, if you're at the wrong end, you get shot. I'm telling you, anybody that's a little bit screwed up in the brain that watches that is very likely to run out and get involved in something. Even if the creed seems dystopian to us, we live in an age that is cynical about the powers of ideas, too comfortable in its convictions that people are ultimately motivated by materialism. Well, most of them are. This is a particularly modern, and it's a good thing maybe they are, because if not, then everybody would be killing everybody. Whoa, wait a minute. I bumped my damn deal here. Stop it. I gotta stop it, man. Well, I hope I'm not reading this twice. While recognizing the cognitive utility of radical ideology, we shouldn't discount the romantic appeal of the ideas themselves. Well, that's the military is like that. I mean, even when I joined the Army at 18, I had certain romantic ideas of going into the military. I didn't have ideas of killing people, but I was going to see the world. Even if the creed seems dystopian to us, there's where I stop. We live in an age that is cynical about the power of ideas, too comfortable with its convictions that people are ultimately motivated by materialism. Yeah, I read that. This is particularly modern myopia, which prevents us from comprehending the inspiration of millenarism, apocalyptic groups. You know, I could have said this whole article in about 5 minutes. I mean, the guy goes on and on and on and on. He makes a lot of phony conclusions, which offer a careful crafted script for salvation. They tempt not only troubled souls. I think the person who wrote this is a troubled soul and is probably a part-time terrorist, but those weary of drab mediocrity. Well, that's most of the people in society are weary of drab mediocrity. With the promise of comradeship, personal or virtual, is a present hereafter. Glory on the battlefield. The dominion over women. Yeah. Beat those women up. Especially sex slaves. Jihadism transforms the fighters from figures who feel passive into active actors shaping history. The other night, my lady and I were out, and we sat across the table from a woman who I believe was involved in taking care of retarded people and, you know, social problems and all that. And I think she knew who I was, but I'm not sure. But she came across with a statement almost like, I must beat my gal. And I said, how would you come up with something like that that you think I might be violent against my woman? And she didn't really have an answer. And I said, well, I have never struck a woman in my entire life. No matter what you think about my politics, never have I struck a woman. But she was thinking along those lines. And, of course, probably still believes it. And probably believed I beat my gal when we got home. No, she beat me. Okay, let's see. And dominion over women, especially sex slaves. Yeah. Jihadism transforms fighters from figures who feel passive into active actors shaping history. Well, that's part of evolution. What do you think evolution is? It's survival of the fittest. And people do go off and, you know, they want to kill the most elephants and they want to kill the most people in the other army and all that. We killed millions of First World War, Second World War. So what's your problem? It's just the way it works. So if one person goes out and goes bonkers and kills a half a dozen people or a dozen people or 100 people, that's really big news. That's nothing. In a world of, in fact, we're probably better off for people to do that instead of getting an army together and killing a million people, like the leaders of our country here in the United States, like Obama, like Bush, like all of them that are warmongering sons of bitches. In a world of bewildering complexity, it abolishes the gray zone and offers them purity and prospect of hegemony. It is a mark of the parochialism, I don't even know what that word means, and Eurocentrism, oh yeah, I like that, of parts of the left, that any analysis of the chauvinism is treated in purely reflective terms as solely a commentary on the sins of the West. Well, most of the sins of the West are promoted by predatory capitalists. For greed purposes. And the ones that are not into that are into religious fanaticism, like the Catholics who killed millions of pagans, Catholics who went running off to the Middle East and killed hundreds of thousands of people there in the Middle East, Arabs and Islamics. And that was okay because they don't follow Jesus. We love the baby Jesus, so we go kill them. A yearning for recognition among a community of like-minded people leads to attempts at emulation. Huh. That sounds... How does that do that? The recognition among a community of like-minded people leads to attempts at emulation? You sound a little sick, buddy. Just because like-minded people like to get together, that doesn't lead to emulation. Unless I forget the proper term here. Emulation. Isn't emulation when they set themselves on fire? No, I guess it's spelled different. A yearning for... David Ali Somboli, who murdered 9 people in Munich before killing himself, sought to emulate American high school shooters and joined a roll call of infamy. His attack was timed to coincide with the 5th anniversary of the massacre of 77 people by Anders Breivik, whom Somboli admired. Although it is unclear whether he shared Breivik's ideology as well as his appetite for mass murder, Somboli, lacking social skills to gain the respect of his peers, had to demand it by terrorizing them. Violence is a failure of the imagination. Wow. Oh, there's quite a bit more to this, but I'm not going to go on with it because people killing people is as old as time. People getting screwed up in the brain and killing people is as old as time. Individuals who form into armies have been killing people since the beginning of time and they've spent more time figuring out on killing weapons than anything else. And so individuals do the same thing. I think the problem is that, now it seems terrible, and it is terrible in a lot of ways, especially if you're the one that gets killed. But killing in society is a normal situation. It's not abnormal. It goes on all the time. And whether it's a lone wolf or an army or the police department or Black Lives Matter, what it is, it's all the same. It's the secret to this, and the bottom line is we're animals. We're of the animal world, and we carry in our genes much animal instinct, and that includes killing. And it's never going to stop. You can try to hold it down and limit it, but you can't stop it. So don't be so shocked when people kill people. Yeah. Just try to make sure that they're not trying to kill you. Like I had a death threat on the internet the other day. This guy's going to get me and do me in the worst kind of way. Well, I can just laugh it off and go down the street, or I can put my gun in my pocket and somebody weird comes around and makes a false move, blow the shit out of him. But most people don't listen to warnings. They don't prepare themselves to defend themselves. Don't worry about defending the country. Wait a minute. One of my problems here is I'm always turning on my speech to talk or to putting words together. And if I don't turn it off when I do my recording, it comes on and interferes. Anyhow, take care of your own ass. Watch yourself at all times. Be careful when you're walking down the street. Don't go into shit neighborhoods. Don't go into bars with niggers all over and a bunch of lowlifes. You know, just observe the normal situation that any sane person could observe, and you'll be all right. You know, it'd be only very rarely that you'd get hurt. Got it? 14.5.